Hi, everyone, and welcome to GRC and Me, a podcast designed to break down the complexities of GRC and turn them into practical strategies that you can use every day. I'm Jane Totaro, and today's episode is a little different and a lot of fun. We're taking you inside LogicAid's Agility Conference, where our CISO, Edwin Ning, sat down with four GRC leaders who don't have much in common on the surface, except that they've all built risk programs under serious, real-world pressure. The panel is called the 2030 Risk Horizon, and the question driving the whole conversation is, what does risk management need to look like in the next 5 to 7 years, and are we actually building for it today? Joining Edwin is Toby Francis, head of cyber GRC at Anglo American, one of the world's largest global mining companies; Cam Karaji, Director of Cybersecurity and Risk at the NFL and a formal Royal Protection Officer; Matt Burton, GRC and Risk Leader at Morgan Zeno Group, a Tier 1 construction company navigating a highly decentralized risk environment; and Oscar Silva Perez, Head of Transformation, Data Strategy, and Assurance at Equiniti and a self-described 6-year LogicAid power user. What you're about to hear is a candid, practitioner-level conversation about the risks that don't make headlines yet, the shift from prevention to resilience, how to actually talk to a board about risk without losing them in the first 5 minutes, and what's fundamentally broken in the way most organizations still run GRC. So whether you're a CISO, a GRC leader, or someone building the risk function at your organization, there's something in the conversation for you. So let's get into it.
Good afternoon. Thanks for joining. Just a quick introduction. My name is Edwin Ning, CISO of LogicAid. This is my fourth week, so please bear with me. I'm still learning the ropes. But welcome to the power panel. We are joined here with a bunch of cyber and risk leaders in their respective areas. I am super excited to host a deeper conversation on how we interact risk in the modern era. Here at Agility today, we showcase AI-driven approach to risk with the workflow agents, as well as Config Newton. I hope you guys were excited about that. And I will be asking the panelists their thoughts with AI in mind on how we shift in defending our ecosystem. But first off, I would like to have the panelists introduce themselves, the company that they work for, their role, and a fun fact, and what keeps them up at night. Something as simple as Arsenal winning the Premier League. But kick it off with Toby.
Good afternoon, everyone. Toby Francis. I'm the head of cyber GRC at Anglo American, which is a mining company. Been there 4 years and very pleased to be here today. I think fun fact, I hate these fun fact sort of questions. Just sort of like, at the end of the day, what is actually fun? I don't know. I think the fact that I've got a microphone on when any of my team will tell me I'm abnormally loud and get banished from the office anyways, I usually end up being pushed to a corner. What keeps me awake at night? Well, you mentioned that Arsenal at one end of the spectrum. Well, supporting Spurs at the other means you're not worried about sort of like any form of winning anything, just avoiding relegation, which is probably apt in my current role. But that's me.
And I heard Toby won an award, but was absent. So
talking to you.
But so proud of you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
All right, Cam.
So I introduced myself earlier. So Cam Karaji, small IT company called NFL. No, I'm joking. The National Football League, Director of Cybersecurity and Risk. Fun fact, when I was Royal Protection, I had to do a burger run for Prince William at 2 o'clock in the morning, which was interesting. So in incognito to go to get a burger for him from McDonald's, which was a weird thing to say, but hey ho. And with the football side, I don't really know much about it. I'm not much of a football or soccer fan. F1 I get, but anything else I don't follow, I'm afraid. So I can't follow this lovely gentleman here.
So what's your favorite NFL team?
What's the right answer? My CISO would say all of them are my favorite teams. That's the politically correct answer. So I'll go with that.
All right. Next up.
Matt Burton. I work for a tier one construction company called Morgan Sindall Group. My role within the business is to try and manage the risk, governance and compliance within a decentralized business. So effectively, I can't tell them what they're going to do, and their regions can't tell them what they're going to do as well. So it is a complete nightmare. What keeps me up at night? It's probably my cocker spaniel that thinks that it's time to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning, 4 o'clock in the morning, etc. And I've forgotten what the other question was already.
Sports.
Sports. Yeah. So the body may not look like it, but I'm doing a half marathon in September, the Great North Run. So look out for me if you're watching it on telly.
Perfect. And then, hello, my name is Oscar Silva Perez. I'm head of transformation, data strategy, and assurance at Equiniti, which basically means I oversee platforms such as Logigate, any transformation activities we need, and run our second line assurance activities. I've worked for two companies that both use Logigate now. So I've been a Logigate power user for about six or seven years now. So quite a while. And I say what keeps me off at night, especially, isn't Arsenal winning the league. I've got over that. Arsenal winning the Champions League, I wouldn't have been able to live with that one. And the correct answer to the NFL question was Chicago, because I've been to Chicago once and seen one game, so they have to.
For some reason, they could never win. So.
The one time I saw them was about 3 years ago, and they played the Patriots and won. And I think they won two games that whole season. So if you fly me over more, maybe they win more games, is what I think here.
Awesome.
So, yeah.
Well, thanks for joining us, all of you guys. Really appreciate your time. Let's kick it off. So the very first question, we talk a lot about risk. Risk has evolved throughout the years. What is one risk that you guys feel that is underappreciated right now that would really matter dramatically in the next 2 or 3 years? I guess let's start with you, Oscar.
I don't mind kicking it off. I think the obvious answer is obviously AI, but going a little bit more specifically, I'd probably say around the coding. One thing that AI is particularly good at is helping to code. But recently there was with Anthropic, with the Mythos, if people know about that, there was a case study where they brought 50 companies together and built a Claude Mythos project. And what they've actually done is used the system and the AI coders to look for vulnerabilities within the companies. And actually there was a 75% success rate. And actually what they found out was the AI code was extremely good at breaking Microsoft's and AI's, Apple's M5 chips. So actually what we've seen from that is, despite being a very small audience, the AI code already has the capability to break some of the most secure environments and protections all around the world. And despite it being fairly contained at the moment, Anthropic are obviously a known company. If this went into the wrong hand, if there was state-backed hackers or anything along those lines, actually the threat landscape of that is evolving quicker than a lot of our systems and cybersecurity measures can keep up with. So AI, generally speaking, but really that code aspect and the vulnerabilities that is being caused from it.
All right. Matt?
It's linked to that. So I agree the AI is the elephant in the room. But it's my concern is the ability to keep up with those risks that are coming as a GRC function and be able to be agile enough to capture all this, monitor it, and then do something about it. So it's more about our ability as a GRC team to keep up with AI and its the risks that it's going to raise.
That was in me, I suppose.
Yeah.
I think... I'm going to move away completely from technology full stop. I think the biggest risk that we see more and more upbringing, I'd say, is people. Because I think, we do amazing work by doing security education, culture and awareness training and all that great stuff. But, is it actually making a difference? Is it actually, are we showing accountability? Are we leading with empathy to those people and making them so that they're partners to us rather than being challenges to the organization? You look out with AI, they'll be using AI, putting commercially sensitive information. Well, that's a data loss prevention issue there and then. So I think for me, it's a big thing is people.
I want to double click on that because me personally, I've experienced in my prior life, people is a, I would say, underappreciated risk in the sense that insider threat is a real thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've actually seen colleagues who are hired that represent nation state actors and they perform like any IT individual there to do work, but they're constantly exfiltrating that data back to the nation state. So I do see that as kind of an emerging threat. All right, Toby.
I think probably I'll pick up on the people theme as well. Probably links to some of what we've heard about material controls, provision 29. As we ask business to take on more responsibility for risk, I think we're going to find a gulf between everybody says they know risk, what they actually understand and what they've committed to. And with this sort of like greater enhanced responsibility around those material controls, I think it's going to bring in a question that risk professionals aren't used to dealing with. That when you come to that annual attestation and sign off, is what are the limits of my liability? What am I signing off here if this is going back to an authority now? I think it's where risk was always quite safe. It was unheard, left in the dark. Yeah, you've got to have a risk register. But now you actually have to attest that you're doing something about it. Do you understand the ramifications of that? We're all putting together sort of like risk treatments. We speak in GRC language. I think it was one of the speakers earlier today said, we've got to speak more in plain English so they understand what we're trying to achieve in battling that risk and getting it to manageable levels and why we're doing it. And I don't think that's fully understood.
Great. All right. Next question. As cyber and risk professionals, we really spent, I would say, the past 5 to 10 years perfecting the art of prevention, something that we have focused on from a technology and process perspective. You know, we talk about technology. EDR is one big one that a lot of companies focuses on. That model has really shifted. It shifted to be more resilience. So how have you guys shifted your operating model to more of a resilience base versus a preventative base risk approach? I guess I'll start with you, Toby.
Thought it might start that way. Yeah, pick a victim. I think around about 2 years ago, that sort of like it became a question of when, not if. You have great SOCs out there. There's been great investment in that tooling, as you've mentioned. But it's actually quite a brittle shell that once you're through, there isn't the same sort of like rigor and depth around those systems, what is required to recover them, in what order. And one of the things that we saw was the conversation around a lifeboat, that minimum viable company became very crucial, which is if the proverbial hits the fan, what do we have to do and in what order? So as we don't have 6 months of absolutely hating ourselves, our colleagues, falling over each other, as we scramble to rebuild systems that may in themselves have been compromised. So it was that idea of the MVC, but getting that management buy-in that this will happen one day. And although we proudly put up on our end of year results, you know, another 5 years and no material breach or serious incident, that's a question of time. There's a numbers game when you look at how the threat surface is changing on the outside. So it's how do you prepare? More importantly, how do you get the business to think about that preparation as well, that lifeboat of what they need to do? So for us, it was really about landing on an MVC and getting that baked into business continuity planning, which obviously sits on the other side of the fence. We're all concerned about disaster recovery, IAM systems, what it takes, but that's interwoven with our business now. And when you bring to them, you go, well, a stoppage in operations against tonnage production at X price per ton means you're probably on the hook for $1.5 billion if you suffer a catastrophic ransomware incident. That focuses attention, but it's also quite scary in what you've unearthed, that what you need to do and what you don't know.
And do you feel like the business has gravitated to support that approach? Or
we've been fortunate. They've very much understood that monetary loss. But again, it's about putting the risk in real terms for them. They're worried about production and tonnage figures. Then you put the loss to them. You don't just state, you know, it's a major risk. It means outage of 6 months. What does that mean? Well, it means no health and safety systems running. Nobody's going to go underground. It means none of the automated systems can actually extract, convey, crush. It all stops. And that realization that for us, mining is no longer a dumb engine, but one that's integrated into your IM corporate network, where leaking that data that's exfiltrated 6 months ago leads to nastier things 12 months down the line, that has resonated. And there's much more work to look at what you can do to save what you can. But the MVC is a great focus, but it's also useful for us in risk when everything is potentially scary. You focus around the MVC as your first sort of like set of controls. You can direct your SOC to look at enhanced monitoring over that minimum viable infrastructure where that those applications and systems sit. So that's worked well. And I think the one thing that we've changed in our thinking. So, you know, it's that activation of that almost left in the dark fifth pillar of NIST recovery, but it's now shifted over and it's much closer to risk.
Great. I'll probably say one thing that was programmed into me as a young officer was something, an analogy called left of boom. And left of boom in my world was boom was the explosion, and boom would hurt people, would be catastrophic to the country or any kind of geopolitical issues that may exist. So all that preparedness before a boom is all the work that gets concentrated from a resilience angle. So as a young serving officer, that would be, how do we act on intelligence? How do we readdress that intelligence into key risk indicators? Is that going to be affected to something about your minimal viable model? But we'd put people into that mix as well. How do we do that in the NFL? Well, it takes a year for every tentpole event, so every international game, we will plan a year in advance. And this is not just the actual game. This is the country, this is the stadium, these are the hotels, these are the partners and law enforcement we work with. The second part of that is also, you look at the massive big tentpole events like the Super Bowl. You know, Super Bowl, every 3 years, it takes 3 years for us to identify a place, and we'll have constantly monthly interactions with that stadium, with that country, or with our state, shall we say, to say, okay, what can we drill into? What can we make sure that left of boom analogy still sits with our stadium? For us, and it's something what you said, and I think the guy from Forrester gave that adequate model earlier, is the boards don't seem to understand key risk indicators, key performance indicators. They're not interested in dashboards. What they're interested in, how much is that going to be costing my bottom line? A second lost in the Super Bowl could be absolutely in its millions compared to a minute in an international game. So finding that right balance in addressing the board is important, and using that same plain English language to get through to them.
And I could attest to that, because during my tenure at Hyatt, I did receive questionnaires from NFL. There were about 200 questions. My team looked at me and said, I don't really want to fill this out. Let's get on a call. And the event was like a year in advance.
Yep.
So it's amazing. Mac?
So as a construction industry, we have always not considered ICT readiness for business continuity, because what do? We build things. There's people on sites out there just doing stuff. But the board has become very focused over the last year or so with the incidents that have gone on, the Carl JLR, et cetera. And then now I've started to ask the questions a little bit more about BCP and ask the businesses, what would you do in the event of BCD? And how would you react with no ICT? And the look of fear on a managing director's face of, what do you mean, no ICT? And because they're becoming more... using it more, and especially with AI as a construction industry, we're starting to use it more and become more reliant on it. This CFO described that every one of her MDs of the divisions actually wrote notes. And that's the first time she's seen them all write notes, because the penny had dropped to them when she posed the question to them. That's focused us. And very much as a group now, we're very much putting an effort into our BCP and not only dusting off the paperwork, going through the process, we're actually testing it as well, sort of thing. And they're understanding that the ICT has got a significant element to play in that, because if you lose your laptop, your phone, we're back to pen and paper. Do you know how you're going to pick up the phone and talk to somebody? And they haven't gone back to that basic stage. So yeah, it's focused everybody's minds very much, looking back at it now.
Yeah, and from my perspective as well, building upon that, if we go back 5 years and we said something like COVID was going to hit, maybe even 10 years now, and you said the whole office has to be out within the space of a day and within the space of a week, we're going to set up at home and it's going to be operational like normal, I think everyone at our firm would have just went, well, there's no chance of that happening. But actually, when reality hit, within the space of 2 days, we were able to pick everything up, work from home, and just work business as usual until we could go back. And I think it's that movement from being reactive from a BCP lens to being more proactive. So I think from us, it's very much going from periodic control testing to sort of more service level disruptions for our vendors, for our key processes. Actually, if this process goes down, if this supply goes down, how long can we last with the service that's in hand? How long can we just muddle through until we have to get it back up and running? And what that's allowed us to do is prioritize actually that level of recovery. So everything that is critical, we've got these recovery times and we can be more proactive about it. Because then if an event does happen, then we can have a very structured, formalized plan. And only when that happens, then we're able to actually show the value of the work that we've done. And I think it's that perception that actually when a big event hits, it's going to be reactive and everything's going to hit the fan and not go particularly well. Actually, a lot of the times that's not the case, because of all the preparation that's done in advance. So I think as sort of GRC professionals as well, our job is very underappreciated for 90% of the time. Until something happens, you can invoke the work that you've done. And as you said, it's not just dusting off. These are enforceable plans. These are recovery times. We can have a structured approach to doing it. And actually moving from a periodic test to a service disruption type model has really allowed us to go to the boards and get some more buy-in from it, especially post-COVID, because it's more realistic now that these events do happen and it's not just people in a boardroom speaking about theory.
So where I mentioned as well that we are very a decentralized business, what we've made clear within our various swim lanes of when this happened is we were going from a very decentralized business to a very command and control business, because in the event of an incident, we've got to take command and control of that instance and manage it in a way that you can't just have anybody phone up the technical lead for a particular function, because if you're speaking to him and asking for an update, he's not doing his job. He's not recovering the system. So that's where we lock it down and say, you've got to stay in your swim lane and you've got to wait for the comms to come out. Because if not, we're going to lose control and we won't be able to recover as quickly, effectively.
Great. So we're kind of at the age of information is relatively available at anybody's hands. Even my kid has asked me, what's Mythos? And I had a very hard time explaining to him. And I guess the conclusion was, okay, AI is bad. And I'm like, no, that's not really what it means. But information is relatively available, even at a board member level. They hear about stuff, they see stuff in the news. What has really changed your approach in making decisions or asking for specific decisions or buy-in at the board level? Like, how have you guys engaged at the board level or senior leadership? What has changed? What is different?
I think from my perspective, one of the things that we've done relatively recently is we've consolidated a lot of our reporting at the board level. Previously, I work across the piece, sort of in a central function within the second lines. We have data protection, information security, enterprise risk management, etc. And actually, how we phrase conversation to the board is massively dependent on the successfulness of the meeting. So if we've got a CISO speaking in their tone and a data protection member speaking in their tone, actually, it looks like we're submitting 15 board packs, and most of that board meeting is spent trying to decipher the information that isn't actually the important part. So actually centralizing the board meetings, and especially with non-executive directors who's not involved in the company all the time, it's really important just to tell them the information that's required. What is the information that you need to leave there with a decision? Because that is the time that's spent on the value added actions. You don't need to go into all of the details speaking about, oh, this is just for your information. This is just to inform you about the situation which is going on. It's phrasing that conversation in a consistent manner to really drive decisions rather than just updating with the members of everything you've done in the last quarter or last year. It's really driving that action.
I would agree with that. You know, it goes back to that plain English. And I think, again, within this conference, it's GRC. We can get wrapped up in a framework, the control. No board is going to care if you're talking about AC01 to 6 or whatever. They want to know what is the real life instance of something going wrong and what does it mean for them. And I think that plain English of what is the purpose, have a very clear plan of what you have to deliver as a message to the board. So as they come away with an understanding of what the issues are. So it's around that plain English. Don't talk about your control framework. Talk about what matters to them, their business, some of the challenges they face arising from that area.
To talk in their language, talk money. That's what the board wants to talk about, is what money, how much is this going to cost me? And the other one is, what do you want? What do we want from them? What do we want them to solve? Do we want money off them? What they want us to do is to tell them what we want. And even if we go to them with a problem, you've got to go with some solution as well. Say, this is the problem, and this is the choices we've got. This is going to cost you X, this is going to cost you X. And that's where they're all quite happy feedback to you. But if you just go with them with a problem, that's not going to help. And if you go with too much technical jargon, that's not going to help. Financial, tell them the problem, tell them what solutions they've got.
But I think we do also need to underpin that with a foundational transparency level. So speaking plain English, having all the data, having all the collateral, and giving him the why and the rationale behind it is great. But being transparent, I think, is a core to building that trust and integrity as you as a professional. One thing we've noticed, especially more and more, is when we are going to the board and giving them that problem statement, giving them that rationale and working through it, they're going to AI and asking that question themselves. So they're going back and say, well, actually, you know, I just know about this. Is this true? So they're misusing our own policy that we've asked them to not specifically do, right? So we know that there's no need to cheat these board members. They absolutely know the truth even before you present it to them. So we have that mindset, actually, you know, let me go up with a plausible experience on what happened, why it happened, but what like you said, what was the outcome? What do I want from them to do? So it's interesting where they're tapping away on their phones and ChatGPT. Oh, I just found out about this. Is this true?
No, you tell them to put the same prompt again. They may spit out a different answer. No, that's interesting, right? I think how would you quantify? Because one of the, at least a challenge that I had when I was a CISO at Hyatt is reputational risk. I mean, how do you quantify that risk to the board? Because it's really hard because they care about reputational risk, but it's very challenging to quantify that. And this may be a curveball, but just really wanted to pick all of your brains on what does that mean to all of you? Because there's reputational risk on everything you guys do, right? NFL is huge.
I think reputationally, I wouldn't even know where to start by evaluating that or measuring that in any way, shape, or form. We were talking about our halftime show this year, was Bad Bunny, right? And we had absolute mountainous of information coming our way because our lovely president, you know, he had his views, whatever the views those are. You know, I'm not here to argue that or not argue that, but he didn't want someone who was non-American performing, right? That affected the NFL's reputational damage, absolutely. But we stuck to our guns. So that, well, actually, no, this is what we believe in. And this multicultural outset that we want to prove is this is our fan base, this is what we want to do. So I can't really fully answer that question. But what I can answer is that we go into markets on the proviso that we do that fan engagement model early. If you were to play in your country, what does that sales look like? What does that trajectory look like? Is there any early forecasting we can see of that? But if you look at a live risk here and now, it's very hard to kind of put a finger on it.
Reputational risk, coming from a mining company, you're starting from a pretty low bar in terms of what you undertake as your activity and how that interacts with the rest of the planet. But we do actually try our best to put that forefront as one of those issues we do care about. We talk about future smart mining. We talk about responsible mining. We talk about working with the communities where we operate. We operate in delicate ecosystems all over the world and put 150-ton trucks in it and start to take away half a mountain. So again, boards do care about what you're doing, and reputational risk sits high. And I think, you know, from that GRC perspective, that is very much factored into their planning when we look at how we interact with local communities. We're very strong on outreach programs. You know, here in the UK, for instance, we run early careers programs in the northeast of the country, where we have mining operations, where most of our great graduate apprentices come through on sort of like the school leaver apprentices come through there. So I think it's very, you know, every board cares about reputation. I think, again, when you talk about risks, what they're concerned about is, it's not just do we appear to do the right thing anymore. It's, are we doing the right thing? Are we doing the best we can, given the operations we have, is the question that you're posed. But I think boards are under greater pressure to be, I think, more transparent, honest about what you can do, what you can't do. And you're held to quite a high bar on that.
I suppose reputation risk, there's always going to be some sort of reputational risk with whatever happens. But I suppose the way you can recover that is how you react to it once it's happened, because you can't stop it from happening sometimes. But depending on the scale of it, whether it's going to be a local reputational or a national or a global reputational risk, is how you react to it and what you do afterwards is probably more important than trying to stop that reputational risk.
Yeah, and I think it's key to always contextualize these risks. Obviously, reputational risk is a category. However, like we can't have siloed working practices, it's not always only going to be a reputational risk. There's going to be a reputational risk. However, if you then have clients' contracts being violated, then you would have a contractual risk and a financial risk and different elements of it. So it's actually overlaying when we speak about reputational risk, what are the other subcategories that are affected? And then sometimes it's hard to get reputational risk the level of attention that it requires. But then if you can feed that into other data protection or financial aspects and actually package that all up as one, we find it quite effective to have that as sort of an end to that conversation and just not treat them as isolated categories as everything is interconnected.
Great. So we talk about GRC, we talk about, I mean, it's being driven real time right now. There's so much things going on. We had discussions around AI, we had discussions around regulatory pressure. What do you guys see as what's not working in the traditional GRC model right now? And what needs to be changed, or what have you guys done differently? I guess I'll kick it off. Toby?
I think, everybody in this room coming from a GRC background works in lean teams. Historically, they've been small, they're not going to get any bigger. And we're dealing with more issues that are becoming more relevant to those businesses. The one thing that we've been working hard on, we talk about plain English, business speak, working with management, but embedding those risk plans within the operational planning of the business. I mean, most of the panel here sits second line. If you try and continue and sort of like introduce this as a risk issue, it lives and dies as a risk issue and can be sidelined. Until it's embedded with the operational planning and the operational model of your business, it won't gain the traction you need. They have the manpower to actually fix these risks. These risks that we find aren't ours. You know, it's always one of the things that always my bugbear is, you know, when you see somebody from the risk team has been put as the risk owner, it's like, no, has absolutely no ability to fix that, has no money, has found the risk. So until it's fully embedded within the business and its thinking and its planning, you're going to be outmatched in resource. And I think it's that where you bleed from second line advisory into partnership with that first line to say, this issue is yours as well. How are we going to deal with it?
And I think building on that as well, I think it's one of the things that has broken in the past is always siloed working practices. Oh, risk have found that, that's a risk issue. Data protection have found that, that's a data protection issue. And all of those aspects, actually, you should correctly say, the resource to fix these issues is normally in the first line, operational lines. So actually, it's working with those areas to be able to fix it and not treating it as a second line issue or a first line issue. But there needs to be a partnership for plans to be created and then where the operational resource is to assist them. I think one of the biggest problems is second line is always perceived as a blocker, or you never want to go to second line because there's going to be issues. And actually debunking that is a big aspect. And with the rise of AI and APIs and all of the different aspects that we're utilizing now, it's only sort of perpetuating that issue. So it's breaking down those barriers and working simultaneously.
Well, I think what we've noticed ourselves is the model of having a business risk owner, like you said, Toby, I think that doesn't always work because the culture and education to that board member or that person that we feel is accountable, it's not the accountable person. So we've decided what we do is, yeah, we absolutely have accountability at a business level, but we have individuals in our team which are called bros. So we're business relationship owners. So we would have a bro per business relationship owner, and we will understand that business through and through. We will know the BIAs, the BCDRs, the resilience plans, the operating models, everything that we need to know about that trajectory. So for example, as broadcasting, we'll be the bro for broadcasting and say, okay, look, we've got this risk. Before we put it through via the system to you, let me explain what this actually means. And the bro model does work. Albeit it's a very interesting term, but it does work for us.
Try to use the bro model of Diego more. You know, that's interesting because from my perspective, oftentimes I've interacted with a lot of CISOs throughout my career, and oftentimes they really look at GRC as checkbox compliance team. That has evolved throughout the years, and with stronger partnership and painting the picture, I think the correct picture of what GRC really means holistically for the organization, I think is imperative for the success of any GRC teams, because GRC does more than a SOC 2, SOC 1 audit. They do more than PCI compliance, right? They're here to really bring value and paint the picture and tell the story of what holistic risk means in the organization. And I would empower anybody in the GRC space to really be the champion in pushing that forward. If they're struggling to interact with business partners because they see them as, no, this is just a checkbox function or a checkbox compliance function.
And I'll pick up on that as well. It's understanding the needs of your companies. We all work in very different industries, very different requirements, and actually what your board, your executive level employees, and actually what your operational colleagues need is vastly different. So actually understanding what are you trying to fix and what is the purpose of what you're doing is critically important, because if you go on the wrong scale, it's highly likely that actually even if you deliver a good output, it's still going to fail because it's not what your organization requires.
Correct. All right, so next question. We all know that IT has been more complex. Technology has been an enabler for a lot of organizations, but that also results to risk around, we talk about non-human identities, the integration of like APIs, all of that. When you think about that, what is the first control you see potentially breaking at scale, and how should we react to that? Oscar?
For me, I think it's not a technical control, but accountability and ownership. It's when there's a physical asset or there's something physical, it's very easy to identify, okay, that is an individual who's going to own it throughout the whole process. However, with API endpoints or the rise of AI, actually, who owns that? Who understands it? It's in our company, I work for a financial firm. We've got some very technical EUCs, and actually a lot of the teams that use them on a day-to-day basis don't understand where the data is coming from. The data hits their inbox, they work through their data, they triage it on thresholds, and then depending on that, they escalate certain elements. Actually, if something breaks in that process, there's very few people who actually understand how it was configured, how it was created. So actually, for me, with non-human indicators and all of this rise that's coming, it's understanding clear accountability levels and ownership levels. So if something goes wrong, then there's a clear level of ownership. Everyone wants to get on board when it's working. And when it's not working, everyone runs for the hills and then you can't fix it quickly. So it is that level of ownership and that people aspect, which can only allow it to be successful.
I think with the ownership as well, what we've, as an organization, we're very good at bringing in new products, bringing in new access controls. But do we ever think about closing the loop and actually removing those access controls and taking away? So if we think about it as a circle, we're constantly tick-tocking. With TikTok, which is enabling all the time, but sometimes we have to take those controls away. We have to take those accesses away. And the only way we can do that, as Oscar said, is by making sure that we have an owner for those automated controls, those AI connections, so that we can actually go to somebody and say, is it still required? Because if it's not, we're going to move away and put that into a cycle where we're not actually just leaving it until they come back to us. We're doing it every 6 months. We're asking the question again, or every 12 months, or whatever suits your business.
We've just put a policy, a model in, which is our continuous exposure monitoring on our side. So we have assets, as in physical assets, the ones we see, the non-human identities. But we go a step further. We actually have roles and responsibilities that are humans, which are also on our asset register. The reason why we do that is because the roles and responsibilities from a PIM-PAM access perspective, we don't know what they are connecting to, why they need that role and access, that availability of administrator access. So we use them as an asset in itself. So when we do a continuous vulnerability assessment, we're picking up on these human behaviors as well as our typical assets are making that drive happen, really.
I'd probably pick up most strongly on that ownership point from that human element. It's painstaking, it's boring, but unless you have that cross-reference, you know, we all work with IM teams that get shiny kit disorder. And they come back from a conference and they talk about this great new toy and you're just like, can we just please fix the repository of way systems that are doing something that we don't quite know why? You know, and that is where we spend a lot of our time in those way system reports. Why is it still there? What's it done? And it's painstaking and, you know, moving to continuous exposure management. Think, you know, those are where you have to go. You've got to automate those sweeps, but it's really about human accountability. Do you understand that business process that's being underpinned and why something is still active? And we get a lot of that. You know, major upgrade comes along and all of a sudden you get calls in from a site in far-flung middle of nowhere going, well, you can't do that, you know, because we've got this system here has been running. You know, I always use the joke, and it lands badly these days because I've got older, but it's like a ZX Spectrum running blast logic controls in a mine somewhere. And you look at it and go, wow, where did we keep that? But it's just been there in this legacy end of life estate that we all deal with. That's what we've got to look at.
So we talk about attack surface. We talk a lot about third parties. I see Toby already making that face, so I'm sure this is a great topic to kind of double click on. But we have less and less control around the attack surface, especially our reliance around third parties to do business. What has changed? I guess, what have you guys implemented to really make third parties measurable? And How you kind of quantify that risk, and how do you take action depending on if the third party is high risk, moderate, low? I mean, just kind of walk me through that. I guess I'll kick it off with Toby.
I think, you know, again, a mining company has many physical assets. So we are massively dependent on external technologies. We are miners who have adopted technology is the way to look at it. We're moving to that state where it's more integrated. But our cyber perimeter is huge thanks to third parties that we absolutely rely on to undertake our business. And I think where we've been shifting the battleground is to get those business teams that are onboarding these technologies to very much consider the security as part of that, that it's not the blocker. Mm-hmm. And I think we've all been like, oh, why are you holding this up? It's a great contract. And it's like, there are a number of fundamental security questions that we have around that supplier. And it's these joint teams between not only the business that want it, the IAM who implement it, and security who sit there. And there was something that we enabled, which is part of contractor performance management. And it was a continual oversight that came in from supply chain that, does it do what it says on the tin? I think more importantly, double checking years down the line after it's been sold to you, what's been upgraded since? We've all probably got architectural review boards that approve this technology before it hits our environment. I bet you find the models that are operating 5 years down the line are a long way different from those initial plans that were submitted. And it's that sort of like need to go back and look at what was promised. Has it been delivered? How has it changed? You know, and we talk about those automation upgrades are made all the time. Systems look fundamentally different further down the road than they do at the time of purchase. So you need to enable the business to put it through a system where, does it still deliver what we want? Is it still cost effective? Is it still safe? Not just that assumption that, well, we did the check, done. You have to come back to a continual assessment program.
Right. We use the defense in depth model. So with the defense in depth model, the crown jewels, the center of what our critical data looks like, what vendor has that access to those critical assets, of the critical data that we have within NFL? Is that game day operation ready or not? We built that into our contractual model. So we asked them to do a self-assessment first. So that, okay, you're going to be touching X environment. What will you be doing with that environment? What legacy information will you have? What actions will you undertake with that information? And then what we tend to find out afterwards is when we do a vulnerability scan through our lovely partners, such as Black Kite, we'll go through further things and we will understand, guess what? There's a second, third, fourth tier vendor that supports that first tier vendor. So our defense in depth model has gone to the wider perimeter now. So from a contractual model, we're now building in that model where we say, okay, I want a full visibility of your second, third tier vendor to make us understand what our business risk looks like.
Within our business, we've got a framework around whole life management of our suppliers. So it's not a snapshot in time with the suppliers. And what the business owner's got to do is not only do that first assessment with us, in conjunction with us, about the supplier, they've got to continually manage it with that relationship with the supplier and address any actions that we may find in that relationship. As an organization that works quite heavily with the government, we're getting pushed down the cyber essentials and the supply chain route. But what we can't do is assure the whole supply chain, because it may go to fourth parties, fifth parties, etc. down. So what we do is we follow a process of called flow down. So the government does it to us, where they say, you are to meet these requirements and you are to flow that down to your supply chain. So we do use the same model. So we put the same requirements onto us, third parties, and ask them to flow that down. So eventually it should take the pressure off us to have to go all the way down, and it should pass down the supply chain, because the government's realized and come to the realization it is not us as the big businesses that are a problem. We've got money to spend on the security. It's lower and further down that supply chain. So that's the bit that we've got to get right.
And for me, that's the interesting part, because we would love to look at third parties, fourth, fifth, sixth, and go all the way down that chain. But I think one of the things we have to say is, realistically, we can't do that. We're going to have to put some levels and some thresholds in place. Is there personal information being accessed? If yes, then you have to do a more enhanced suite. And actually, tiering the suppliers has allowed us to be able to spend more time to focus on the ones which have the highest risk. So in an ideal world, we'd do all suppliers down to four, fifth parties, but because the resource doesn't allow it, there has to be a level of tiering and threshold to allow you to spend more time on the ones which could give you the highest exposure. And then, as you said, it cannot be a once-off event. It has to be on a yearly or biannual basis, depending on that risk tiering, to allow you to be able to keep an up-to-date picture. There's no good in 10 years' time with a supplier, all of their controls have lapsed, but actually, at the point in time of your assessment, they were all working perfectly. If you get a cyber breach, you've still got a cyber breach. So it needs to be a continuous process and not seen as a once-off.
We follow Oscar's model with the suppliers. How much access they have to our data and how much access they have to our network. And then we tier suppliers, because depending on that is how much effort we put into the assessment. Because they don't have access to the network or the data, they probably don't need as much effort from us.
Awesome. So we're heading towards the end of this discussion. I do want to ask all of you guys, being leaders in the GRC space, one advice in one or two sentences that you would give leaders across this room or just prospect GRC folks that really want to tap into this field. I guess start with you, Oscar.
Yeah, I think the one biggest thing that I got told when I joined the second line is don't be a blocker. Second line has always been perceived historically as, oh, you go to them and they're the no people. It's always be the yes, if. So if somebody comes to you with a contract value of £10,000 and they're going to really expose the company, yes, we can do that if you go and get £10 million worth of insurance. And actually, the business start to regulate themselves. They don't want to pursue these opportunities. But as a second line, you have enabled them to do it if they can follow your processes. So I think optics is as important as the results aspects as well.
I don't think you should take on the role of being the SME on everything as well. Go and use your team to get those answers. And don't be afraid if someone asks you the question to say, I don't know. Yeah. But I'm going to get the answer for you and make sure you go back to them. You can't be the expert on everything. So use your team, use the experts in your team to answer the questions you don't know about.
So I'll lead with the same sentiments, I'd say, to be fair. I'd say for me is lead with empathy. I think that's really important. The understanding of the business, the contextual usage of it, and you as a risk professional, we all have teams who are going through an unbearable amount of pressure. And sometimes as leaders, we need to kind of take that pressure on board and kind of see what that empathetic leadership would look like for them. That will empower that individual to make more clear, conscious decisions in my perspective.
All right. Toby, how about you?
I think it was a piece of advice I was given about career in general, but it applies to leadership, which is you have two ears, one mouth. Use them in that order. Listen, understand. It could also have been one well-meaning mentor saying, just be quiet, you got to be what name? But you'd have to ask my team whether I actually live those values. But really understand what the issue is. We're under pressure to rush to the answer. You know, solutionize everything. It takes time sometimes. I know there's a pressure for that on-the-spot answer, but have you really understood everything? Think about it, pause, then act. Because generally, if you understand the root cause, your answer is going to be fundamentally stronger. And I think you've got to the root of what the issue might be.
You know, I'm going to wrap it up. I think from my perspective, I feel like someone always chimes in and says what I want to say. But from my perspective, it's always start with empathy as well as understanding and end with collaboration. I mean, that's the only way to be successful, especially in the GRC space. But thank you guys, amazing. Thank you for the attendance. Thank you for having this discussion. And thanks for being here at Agility.
Thank you very much.
And that's a wrap on the 2030 Risk Horizon. If you've been nodding along, you're probably thinking the same thing I am. The GRC profession is at an inflection point. The risks are bigger, the boards are sharper, the regulatory pressure is mounting, and the old playbook isn't going to hold up. What stuck with me the most? When every single panelist converged on the same closing advice: listen more, speak in plain English, lead with empathy, and stop letting jargon get between you and the people you're trying to protect. If you enjoyed this episode, share it with someone on your team or someone in your organization who still thinks GRC is just a checkbox exercise. This conversation might change their mind. Subscribe to GRC and Me wherever you get your podcasts, and we'll see you on the next episode. Until then, stay curious, stay resilient.